Welcome to the Know No Strangers podcast, where attorney and legal advocate Bill Robinson shares life lessons and inspiration.
Good afternoon, my friends. This is William Robinson, and welcome again to another edition of my podcast, Know No Strangers. And I am so happy and delighted that you have taken the opportunity to listen to conversation I'm having today, because it's one of the most important and one of the most valuable conversations I've had. I always talk to you about reading books, and the Pulitzer Prize was just awarded to a Norwegian gentleman named John Fosse, who wrote a book about being a painter and life in Norway. And it was about a relationship between two men in Norway. And it was a very, very powerful, valuable book, in that his spirituality comes through, his Christianity comes through, and the facts of life come through very clearly. You could see why this man was nominated for the Pulitzer. Actually, he won the Pulitzer Prize. Last month, we interviewed Desmond Mead, who was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. And today, we're going to interview a lifelong friend of mine who may be a nominee for a Genius Award or the Pulitzer Prize in the near future. It's a very interesting story. We met each other when we were 14 years old, both went to college and graduate school together, hailing from New Haven, Connecticut, that very small town in the Northeast, very liberal bastion of education at Yale University. And he has gone on to become a distinguished doctor and a distinguished alumni and a world traveler who has inspirations to help the people of Africa. Dr. Guy Williams is here today. And Dr. Williams and I have been friends for so long that it's going to be a very casual conversation. But the reason I asked him here today was to talk about his recent ventures in Africa. Guy is a world traveler and has a heart for people, and is working with helping our brothers and sisters in Africa in a most genuine and generous way. Dr. Williams, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Attorney Robinson. Appreciate that. And I appreciate the kind introduction that you gave me.
Well, it's all true. Tell us about Kenya, Guy. How did you get involved in Kenya?
Well, I had been practicing emergency medicine and a number of forms of medicine for about 30 years. And one of my partners, Dr. Chris Wahalik, was soliciting funds to help this project called the Virginia Wright Clinic in Kapkimich, Kenya. At that time, he was the medical director of the program. And I went over to Kenya with him. Primarily, the project is based upon helping the young ladies at the St. Anne's Girls School. We have, of course, about 240 girls there at this point in time, but one of the girls got injured and she was unable to receive health care in the area that this clinic is located, Kapkimich, Kenya. And she had to go 20 miles to get the wound cleaned and have the wound addressed. And at that time, this is 2017, the idea was promoted that we would start basically a first aid station, so that the young ladies at the school have access to bandages, Tylenol, ibuprofen, female hygiene products, and the like, and deal with some of their personal health care issues that could be managed in that setting. However, when the clinic opened, the whole community embraced the clinic, and subsequently, it was a station where everybody in the community would come and get these over-the-counter medications and these things for wounds and antibiotic ointments and those kind of things. When I first got there, I was embraced by the community. I saw the potential of this model to not only address the healthcare needs of these young ladies, but also to the healthcare needs of the community, and also the educational opportunities that this could provide primarily to HBCUs, in terms of summer externships to students, as well as bringing the HBU medical schools on board. And this could possibly be a place to have them come to do externships clinical rotations during their educational process. And that's primarily where we started. The clinic has come quite a long ways in the last 3 years. When you are looking at bringing in outsiders, so to say, especially students to this environment, you have to have the facilities that the students would need, or the interns or residents or visiting faculty. So for the last 2 years, we've been preparing for this in terms of actually building out a place where they can actually come and practice medicine.
Now, doctor, this is in a rural community or urban area? What city or where are you near? Explain a little bit about that.
The closest major town is Saram, which is about 3 miles away, but we are outside of Nairobi, northwest of Nairobi, going toward the Maasai area, the Maasai Mara. Typically, when I go to Kenya to visit the facility, I have to fly to Nairobi, and then I would have to catch another flight to either Eldoret, which is about an hour's flying time, or Kisumu, which is about an hour flying time. And then the drive to the clinic is approximately an hour and a half. To put it in perspective, the town of Eldoret, where people can obtain x-rays, is 60 kilometers. The other closest x-ray machine is in Kakamanga, which is also about a 50-minute ride. And then to Kisumu is close to 50 kilometers, which is close to about a 40-minute ride. So as you can see, we're in a health service shortage area, especially for tertiary care, where the place of the previous cities that I mentioned is where they would go to, so to say, a real hospital to provide life-saving measures. So we're positioned perfectly to be a stopgap in these health service shortage areas and provide another level of care, so therefore people may be able to stay in their communities and receive care in their communities.
So how are these, is this a public health situation? You said there's 240 people in the school. They pay for the school themselves, or how does that work?
Well, Kenya has a public education system, but it's not free education. For your child to go to high school, it's approximately $400 US a year to go, even though the Kenya government will provide a certain number of teachers on that budget, supply books, supply housing, or those kind of things. But they require that the parents of the children supplement the system. And like I said, it's approximately $400 a year to send your daughter, in this case, to the St. Anne's Girls School. It's not a Catholic school. It's just named St. Anne's, but it's a public school in Kenya. Mm-hmm. And that's the model there. The education-based system is that once you've gone through high school, if you pass the test, which is the big test that everybody takes in Kenya, if you pass that test, then you're granted admission to the university for free. Okay? If you do not pass the test, then you're eligible for secondary education, like to become a medical technologist, or you could become a pharmacy technician or something like that. But in terms of going to nursing school, going to medical school, going to get a business degree, economics degree, or political science, you want to train to be a lawyer, you have to pass that test to get into university. So our model primarily supports the educational process of these young ladies, so therefore more will qualify to receive education at the university. And how we support the school is the St. Anne's Girls School Project, that we have fundraisers in the U.S. Currently, right now, we pay the tuition for 172 of the girls attending the school. Great. We also supplement the school in terms of we hired 4 additional teachers to help them keep up with the caseload of the number of students that they educate. So we hired a physics teacher, we hired a biology teacher, we have a new math teacher in terms of supporting the teachers that the government already provides. We also support them nutritionally in terms of the school has to buy foods given the money that they receive from the government, but also to help balance out their diet, we'll also supplement funding for there so to diversify and secure their food source. And we recently built a brand new dormitory for the girls to stay in that support them in terms of giving them better living conditions.
Great.
So that is the model. And then the healthcare center has subsequently come on to that. And we also have a third leg of this project in terms of supporting the schools is that we started a micro loan program, so to say, for young ladies that want to be entrepreneurs and go into black hair care products, the nail industry, uniforms, because all the kids in Kenya wear uniforms. They may want to get into clothing and some of their other ventures, start their own farm where they can bring foods to the market. So we're also supporting that as well.
Is there a large opportunity for people to help in ventures like this, or what do you see as the future of your vision?
Well, we've been fortunate in that the clinic itself now, we recently had the lab is certified by the federal government. So therefore, anybody that can come to our clinic, have their labs drawn and have their labs done at our clinic, and we will receive reimbursement. Our pharmacy has been certified by the federal government now. So now, additionally, we can fill prescriptions to our healthcare providers or our patients, but also to independent providers in the countryside can write prescriptions and people can present to our pharmacy to have those prescriptions filled. And we do receive a supplementation from the government. And the clinic itself has recently been certified by the federal government. And we now partake in their, so to say, the Affordable Health Care Act or Obamacare, how appropriate being Obama having his legacy in Kenya. Now we are certified where we can provide care for those individuals that partake in the National Health Insurance Program. We can also provide care for them. Granted, the reimbursement is not as much as you would have in the American market. We receive approximately $10 for a pediatric, adolescent, or adult office visit. We are delivering babies at the facilities. We deliver anywhere from 3 to 15 babies a month. The reimbursement for delivering a baby in Kenya, we receive $30 from the federal government for that. So even though these margins are not large, it still put us in a place at this point in time where we are receiving financial reimbursement from the government. We are a certified healthcare provider by the government, and we're looking to drive up our percent utilization of people in the area that do have the Affordable Health Care Act to steer them to our healthcare facility.
What's the population in the area, Guy?
The population in the area, we have close to 1,000 kids. Our girls' school has 240 girls. The grade school has about 700 some odd kids. And the other boys' high school has about 300 students. All children in Kenya underneath age 18 are approved for the Federal Affordable Health Care Act. So therefore, all of those students were able to see at our facility and offer care and receive some reimbursement. But the town of Seram and the surrounding areas, close to about 20,000.
Spell Seram in case somebody wants to look it up on the map.
S-E-R-A-M, Seram.
Okay, mm-hmm. Okay. So what are some of the health issues that you see in this rural community? It seems like people would be very healthy out in the country there. Is that a misconception?
Well, the truth of the matter, healthy in respect to what we see in the United States is hypertension being one of the number one things you see in African Americans. However, because of their diet, low salt intake, a lot of walking, hypertension is not one of the main killers of their population. Our type 2 diabetes and type 1 diabetes, we don't see a lot of that because of people have low weight. Their carbohydrate intake is very low because it's primarily a 80% vegetarian diet. We do not see the increased risk of heart disease related to heavy consumption of animal byproducts. steak and beef alike. But our number one killer is malaria. We are in an endemic malaria area. There's malaria in this part of Kenya. Number two is brucellosis, which is a disease that's transmittable from cattle to humans. Because the Maasai primarily operate on a cattle culture, if you want to get married, it's about 13 cows that you have to put in a diary for a wife. And we laugh about it because during COVID, it went down to 7 cows to get a wife. But now that the economy's improved, the prices have gone back up, as we see here with inflationary pressures worldwide. They're not immune to that. Third is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Even though nobody smokes, you think that that would be very low. But when you have cooked over wood for 60 years, it affects the female population tremendously, breathing smoke 3 times a day to provide meals for your family. So we do see chronic obstructive pulmonary disease in terms of our top three to eradicate. Malaria prophylaxis, a lot of people in this area, they're not privy to have malaria pills. Like when I go to visit the clinic, I take my malaria tablet every day as directed. In terms of brucellosis, brucellosis has been eradicated in the United States. In the United States, we have what's called official calf hook vaccination, where all cows less than 8 months of age are checked for brucellosis. And then if they're negative, they receive the brucellosis vaccine. The only brucellosis left in the United States are those in the buffalo that inherit Yellowstone Park. There's still brucellosis there. And the ranchers often get excited when the buffalo come out of Yellowstone and approach their fence lines in Idaho and Montana and those kind of things, that they'll transmit brucellosis to their cattle herds. So they shoot the buffalo or those kind of things. But we are engaging with Tuskegee University School of Veterinary Medicine to have vet students come out and actually start a small program where we can create a brucellosis-free herd and then expand upon that concept. So therefore, the individual that work with their cattle will not be exposed to brucellosis, and we can start decreasing the amount of brucellosis in the area that affect our patients. It causes chronic disease, it causes premature births, it causes abortions, chronic skin manifestations, and through the organ system. Brucellosis is kind of a chronic disease that once you get it, it's very hard to eradicate. But we do use antibiotics and those kind of things for that.
So, Guy, you said it's a school of women, St. Anne's, and what do you envision these women doing well in school and staying healthy and going on to college? What do you see for the future?
Yeah, that's the goal. My vision for the area is to turn it into an academic medical center, in that we would be able to get students. I've been charged by Father Anthony, whose family's been very nice, to donate land so that we can build this, what we're building there. He's charged me to bring HBU excellence to Kaptamich, and to put these students in front of their girls to teach them courses, biology, coding, chemistry, business, entertainment, drama, singing, theater, to give them a visual representation of what they can be, but also hopefully in the near future, as we continue to build out the infrastructure, that we'll be able to invite HBCU medical schools to this area. So therefore, it'll be a win-win situation. The students of Kaptamich will be able to enjoy the best and the brightest that we have to offer in terms of giving them a vision for the future, as well as a pathway in terms of mentorship, but also the education of our medical students, as well as dental students on things like infectious disease, tropical medicines, those kind of things that they don't see in the United States. So therefore, with the world becoming much smaller, if a person gets on a plane and he may have outbreak of malaria, but he ends up in a hospital in Houston, Texas, the healthcare providers there may have never treated anybody with malaria or brucellosis or Chagas disease or sleeping sickness or the other things that they may have a chance to see, worm infestations and those kind of things that we take for granted from having clean water, those kind of liver flukes, and it goes on and on. But that they would be better prepared for that. I remember in my case training at Howard and then going to Michigan to do my residency in a 90, I was the first African-American resident there, but to be in a 99% white environment and you have a young male or female, they may have sickle cell anemia and sickle cell crisis, to come to a position, place like that where no no majority physician has ever seen anybody with sickle cell, let alone knows how to treat sickle cell crisis, or another number of things that we possess uniquely to our African American health picture, that this would benefit the medical community here as well.
So, doctor, you've been going back and forth to Kenya for a couple of years now. How many years? 4 or 5?
3 years. Yeah, it's been four years. 4 years now.
All right, and you've obviously established some relationships. Tell us about some of the students that you've grown fond of.
Oh wow, you can't beat the love, the welcoming smiles, the warm embraces. The curiosity about what we're doing here as opposed to what they're doing there. You watch the young ladies get on YouTube and TikTok and all this kind of things, and how they try to mimic the African-American experience, so to say, with style and grace and sayings and mannerisms and those kind of things. But they are just happy with so little. But I guess a dirt floor is fine until you see linoleum, you know, and linoleum is fine until you see hardwood. That's fine until you see granite and then marble. But they are eager to learn. They're excited about their lives. They're excited about going forward and making better lives. And they're thirsty to learn. That was my first impression, in that it's one thing to give healthcare and educational opportunities to this community, but I saw it could be so much more in terms of what our diaspora can bring to the people of Africa. And I'm not saying this to be in any way derogatory, but during my visits, and I've been to Senegal and Ghana and Zambia, Botswana, Zimbabwe, South Africa, and now I'm in Kenya. But the usual model of NGOs, non-government organizations that are in Africa now, whether it be food stabilization, whether it be healthcare, whether it be famine and drought, whether it be all the other, the thousands of things that the African continent is dealing with, is that it is usually a majority organization that is there to render aid or render help in some type of way. But the African-American diaspora is some of the brightest people that we have on the face of this earth. And not only that, but our wealth in terms of the economic impact that we produce in this country. I just would like to present a model to them that is different, in that they see people of their same likeness reaching out to help, provide opportunities to be role models, and to bring them, not to sound cliche, but to bring them Black excellence. And going forward, I think that we, the African-American diaspora, need to be more conscious of our ability to invade this space and to not only that, but ingratiate it and make it better. I'm tired of, yes.
How were you received by the local Kenyan doctors there?
The local Kenyan doctors are very receptive. They want continuing medical education. They want their jobs, so to say, lessened because they're overburdened, overworked, lack of resources. And in any way, the establishment of our clinic, for instance, the government has a clinic in Saram that their clinic is so poorly staffed and so poorly equipped that they come to our facility to get medications, to get bandages, to get dressings, to help people that they're seeing at the government clinic, and we're better staffed than the government clinic.
Wow, wow.
So we're very much have become, within a three-year period, becoming a major player in the healthcare for this community. Because like I said, I went down to Kakamanga to look at their hospital, and there were hundreds of people just waiting outside. Some there for a couple of days trying to get healthcare. The maternity ward where you deliver your baby and basically you're back out on the street with a baby within 4 hours. Because somebody else needs to get in that bed to have to go into labor and deliver. So it's a very tough environment. Kenya is still struggling with the, you know, colonialism that persisted throughout all of Africa. Natural resources being harvested, but no financial gain that the actual people can see. In terms of billions of dollars of revenue, and you just pick your country, and whether it's Liberia for rubber, whether it's, you know, Congo for palm oil, whether it's Kenya for tea, whether it's South Africa diamonds, cobalt, gold, you know, that these resources, as they're sold as commodities, they do not come back to the community to help the people that are there. So that's a very perplexing problem that goes on, and that will probably continue to go on for some time to come, until the people are actually able to harness their natural resources, they get paid for their natural resources, and then take those finances and spread those to the people to raise the standard of living for these communities.
Well, Doctor, it's been really a pleasure to have known you all these years, and to see you mature and develop and go back to Africa and to help so many people. Tell the listeners out there how they can assist in your efforts to bring healing and care to St. Anne's School for Girls.
Well, at this point in time, we do have a website that is up. It's called Envision Kenya, ENVISSON Kenya. .com, and it will tell you a little bit about the story of our involvement with the St. Anne's Girls School and the birth of the Virginia Wright Health Center.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah.
So hopefully it's kind of like a field of dreams. I was told by the president of HBCU Medical School, guy, I can't give you any money to build anything, but if you build it, we'll come. So so at this point in time, we're continuing to build, and with the hope that they will come. Yes. And we'll make it very welcoming. We're very well received by the community. They can't wait till more of us come to continue this process and engage them.
Well, thank you for being with me here today and sharing your African experience. And This is my podcast, Know No Strangers, and I'm here with my best friend in the world, Dr. Guy Williams, and we really appreciate your listening. And remember, we as Africans all can help each other. We love each other, and we've got to spread the love and help our communities grow and develop to be what they can be. Thank you, Dr. Williams.
Thank you very much, Tony Robinson. Appreciate you having me.
Thanks for listening. To learn more about Mr. Robinson's legal practice, visit WilliamCRobinsonAttorney.com.